We are now entering the last couple chapters of Revelation. Revelation 21, we're going to look at the first 8 verses. And as I was looking at these chapters, I think, including today, we have 3 more sessions remaining.
So we need to think of something.
Good, because we'll finish before we, disappear.
So these first 8 verses, they read, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. Also he said, Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death." So some first thoughts. This wedding between the Lamb and the Bride that was described in chapter 19, or that was implied in chapter 19, is finally here. Chapter 19 mentioned the marriage supper of the Lamb, which obviously then implies some kind of wedding. Well, it's finally here. The Bride is the New Jerusalem, and the New Jerusalem is going to be described in the second part of chapter 21 and the first part of chapter 22.
Historically, the Bride's been the church, people.
The Bride, the New Jerusalem, the 144,000, the servants of God, the saints, the martyrs under the altar, the great multitude, the church, Israel, they are all the same. It's the Bride.
Lots of words.
It's just that New Jerusalem is coming here instead of is here, but okay.
If this was a play, The one thing that you'd be able to see is that the person that came out to play all of those characters would have been the same person dressed up differently. So it would have been easier to know
that, would be interesting.
That, you know, oh, that's the same person. That's the same one. That's the same one.
Maybe for Wes and Linda, we should clarify. We're primarily looking at what Revelation meant to the people who first heard it.
Yeah.
And it was presented as a drama.
Was written as a dramatic way.
A spoken drama, and
to be done.
We're looking at what it meant to first century Christians. Quite interesting.
New Jerusalem is a city. The other city that we've seen is Babylon, and so New Jerusalem is then a literary counterpart to Babylon, and the marriage is a counterpart to the sexual immorality that was associated with Babylon. So again, sexual immorality in Revelation is not speaking about it in a literal fashion, but in a metaphorical sense. Symbolic. Some other things. Now, what are the allusions and references back to earlier parts of Revelation, the Old Testament writings, and the Gospels? And a few observations here. The phrase, "it is done," resembles what Jesus said on the cross, "it is finished." Or maybe they're similar, maybe they're not. Who knows? The concept of thirsty and the water of life echo John's Gospel account, and we have noted throughout that the author of John's Gospel and the author of Revelation may or may not be the same. The the scholars are not in agreement there. There's some evidence that say, okay, they may be the same, but there's also evidence that say, no, they're really not the same. The concept of dwell or dwelling place. Again, John's Gospel uses the same term in John chapter 1, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. This word dwelt or dwelling place is literally tabernacle or tabernacled, tent, tented.
Which gospel says you are the tabernacle of God?
That's one of Paul's letters.
Paul.
And we can, John chapter 1 is a type of creation account that echoes Genesis. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and through the Word everything was created, etc., etc. Revelation 21, is this also an echo of Genesis, the new creation? This set of verses talks about conquering, and that takes us back to the letter to the seven churches. There was promises to conquerors made in those letters. So it brings Revelation all the way back to the beginning of the book. Some other repetitions from earlier in the book include things like a loud voice or the throne, the command to write this down, the phrase trustworthy or faithful and true, the imagery of the lake of fire, the phrase second death. And finally, the question is, verse 8 lists a list of sins or lists of vices. Are they to be taken literally or are they also symbolic? Some literary features. So in chapter 20, the third in the spirit section finished. There are four of them in Revelation where John is said to have been taken into the spirit, or I was in the spirit. And so the third in the spirit section, what did it describe? Well, it described war and judgment against Babylon. It described the beast, the false prophet, and the dragon, and they, all of the war and the judgment are finished. Death and Hades are no more. The fourth in the spirit section is about to begin, starting with verse 9, which follows this introductory section. So these first 8 verses in chapter 21 is an introductory passage to the fourth in the spirit section. So the three in the spirit sections in Revelation, the first one was about Jesus walking among the lampstands and the letters to the seven churches. The second in the spirit section described the throne in heaven, the scroll and the lamb, and the opening of the seven seals. And the seven trumpets we saw were part of the seventh seal. And in the seventh trumpet, it was what that described was the woman and the dragon, the beasts, the 144,000, the three angels, the judgment, the seven bowls with the seven plagues. The second in the spirit section was the longest of the in the spirit sections. And we just talked about the third in the spirit section, which described the judgment and the fall of Babylon, the rejoicing in heaven, the marriage supper of the Lamb, the destruction of the beast and the false prophet, the millennium, the destruction of Satan and death and Hades. Conquering is a theme that occurs throughout Revelation. And this structure, loose chiastic structure, comes from reading Revelation. In the letters to the seven churches, there's promise to him who conquers. The counterpart is in chapter 21, verse 7, there was a promise to him who conquers. It is seen that the Lamb has conquered. And later in the book, the Lamb was shown to have conquered the 10 kings. In chapter 11, the beast was said to conquer the two witnesses. And in chapter 13, the beast is allowed to conquer the saints. Right in the middle, in chapter 12, the Lamb's followers, the saints, they are the ones who conquer the beast.
Was 12 kind of the climax of the book?
12 is kind is the center of the book. It is the it provides the main point.
Is there a general chiastic?
There is.
There is. Okay.
So who does the lamb talk?
Who did the lamb conquer? Oh, in 5?
The lamb.
So who conquered the dragon?
This says so, the beast.
Yeah, I know.
The beast, the dragon,
I think there's
all that.
There's something here about who's conquering who. I think the lamb conquered the dragon.
Lamb, yeah. Actually, it's in chapter 20. It was the lamb and all of his followers that march out, that ride out to war against the dragon.
In chapter 5, it doesn't say who the lamb conquered at all.
No, it...
The lamb triumphed and is worthy.
I don't know, maybe I'm off, but does it seem important that the followers of Christ conquered the beast, which was the image to the, which was the one that was the image to the dragon. So it's kind of like God took care of the dragon, mm-hmm. and we have to take care of the beast.
I think there's a point to be made there.
It's a system.
It's
a world system.
It goes along the exhortation to the church to remain faithful.
The battle's already been won because the dragon's already been destroyed. But we still got to do the mock-up.
Yeah. The war is won.
Been done.
And it's not literal. This is a play. This is a drama. So in my head, it kind of makes sense.
Interesting.
The one of the messages here is that the promise to him who conquers, well, who conquers? It's the Lamb's followers who conquer. And there should be no question as to whether or not they conquer, because it has already been given that they will.
That is what John has been trying to say from the beginning of Revelation. Is that, well, his climax was in the middle, but it was that this is a cadence that God has given us this blessing the day on the cross, and that it's been given for all who are here to hear it, always. And there's no fear, there's no worry of all of these things that are crashing or coming. Because your strength has been given if you were willing to take it. There.
So kind of from, you know, if we look at the structure of a drama, we have begin with an introduction, an exposition, then you have a rising action, you have conflict, falling action, and then it generally ends with what's the French term, denouement. So now, as we enter chapter 21, the antagonists are defeated. Now, the conflicts themselves have resolved. There is no more conflict. Now we enter the denouement. The purpose of that is to bring down the tension. The technical term is catharsis. Now we had the audience has all this emotion, all this tension, all this excitement, and it needs to go somewhere.
So then, now they get to see the hero of the story rewarded.
Yeah, it provides the final resolution. Mm-hmm. And it provides the rest of the story. No, it's not nearly as important as the conflict and its resolution. No, but emotionally, the audience needs some time to let their emotions resolve now.
Experience the beauty that is a result of the conflict that they've seen.
Yeah, I never really liked it, but it's like your victory march.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or if it's over sin, the victory march will be wonderful.
Right.
It's actually less dramatic than the victory march.
And actually the victory has been done so long ago, but this is the culmination of just the fruition of the whole thing.
So let's just take it. I'm going to go verse by verse today. And then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. This comes directly from Isaiah chapter 65, verses 17 through 19, where it describes a new heaven and a new earth.
There's no ocean in heaven.
Isaiah 65, 17 to 19, which reads, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress." The heaven and earth passing away is an echo of Revelation 20, verse 11, where it read that heaven and earth fled away and they could not be found. And verse 4 of chapter 21 also has the phrase, "former things have passed away," so it provides kind of an inclusio, a bookend of these first four verses, saying that the old is gone. And that's further emphasized, I think, by the description that the sea was no more. What does that mean? The sea, if you recall, was one of the places where the dead were called out of earlier in Revelation. For the ancients, the sea represented a source of chaos.
Uncertainty.
It's the, and if you go all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, you have the image of a vast emptiness of water, the chaos of water that precedes creation. So it represents the primeval chaos prior to the first creation. Now, in Greek comedy form, often the end is better than the beginning. The first creation, described in Genesis 1, still left the world with the sea. What it seems then represent would be that chaos and trouble is right next door, just waiting. It's not perfect. But the new creation will have no sea. In other words, there is no more possibility for chaos to return. It's not that there is not going to be literally a sea anymore. For people who love the ocean, for people who love the sea, you know, this is not proof that the New Jerusalem will not have any more oceans or seas. You may have boats there. You may have ocean-going vessels.
But whatever there is, we won't remember it,
it says. It represents fear and
yeah. So this sea no more is metaphorical. It's not a literal physical description.
Almost the whole book is that way.
I wish we can go to heaven, huh?
Then it reads, "And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." The holy city and the New Jerusalem was mentioned earlier in Revelation chapter 3 and Revelation chapter 11. The picture of New Jerusalem coming down from heaven was found all the way at the beginning in one of the letters in Revelation chapter 3. The idea of prepared as a bride that echoes back to Revelation 19:7, where it mentioned the marriage supper of the Lamb and the bride preparing herself. It's also a reference to Isaiah 61, verse 10. And that reads, if I can get to it. "I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall exalt in my God, for he has clothed me with the garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decks himself like a priest with a beautiful headdress, and as a bride adorns herself with her jewels." So the image of preparing oneself for a wedding is found in Isaiah. Passage in Revelation continues, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God." We have encountered loud voices in earlier passages in Revelation, and it always precedes an announcement of something that is important. The idea of the dwelling place of God is with man. One reference is found in Revelation chapter 7, verse 15, which we'll go to, which reads, "Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple, and he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence." The idea of sheltering, the idea of dwelling, the idea of tabernacle, kind of a shelter, a roof over people, is the image that we're getting here. It's the same word. The most direct Old Testament reference comes from Leviticus chapter 26. And this, in verses 11 and 12, which read, "I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul shall not abhor you, and I will walk among you and will be your God, and you shall be my people." This is in a passage in Leviticus where it is describing blessings for obedience and punishment for disobedience. There's also a reference to Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 27. And that reads, "My dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." Basically, borrowing the text from Leviticus. So this idea of God dwelling among his people is a theme that comes from the Old Testament. The Gospel account of John also speaks about this idea of dwelling place. So we mentioned the passage in John chapter 1 already, but we can also refer to in chapter 14, where it talks about where Jesus is saying, "I'll go and prepare a place for you so that you can be with me. Prepare a dwelling place." So the theme, the motif of God wanting to be with his people is a theme that occurs throughout. Passage in Revelation then continues, "He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away." No more tears, no more death. We find that in earlier in Revelation chapter 7, verse 17, as well as chapter 20, verse 14. And this is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 25, 8 as well. We read the passage from Isaiah 65 talking about no more crying or weeping. The idea of former things having passed away can be found in Isaiah 42, verse 9. And it was mentioned at the beginning of this passage in verse 1 of chapter 21. This is commentary from reading Revelation. The key to understanding chapter 21, verses 1 through 4 is the affirmation in chapter 21, verse 3, which reads, "Behold, the dwelling of God is with people." First, it explains the vision of the new heaven and new earth, or the new Jerusalem. Second, the five promises that follow are simply commentary on it. Once again, the central defining affirmation is nothing less than the reaffirmation of a central defining affirmation to Israel, referring to Leviticus 26, verses 11 and 12. So the bride of Christ, not ethnic Israel, is the true Israel. Now, throughout Revelation, John, the author of this book, has been emphasizing that the term Israel is not an ethnic term, a national term, a physical term, but rather a spiritual term that applies to all who follow Christ.
By and large, his audience was
Jews.
The Gentile Christians?
Jews and Gentile Christians.
So it wasn't, his audience wasn't the Jewish nation.
No.
And the promises that follow are a description of God living with us. That makes sense. Rather than saying here's what's going to happen next, he's describing what life looks like when God comes and dwells with you.
Yes, that is what I've been hearing the whole time. That instead of it, the heavens are raining down, everybody's dying, the world is terrible. It's more like all of these trials, the worst that could possibly happen is doable because Christ is on this sin with you all the time. Mm-hmm. And none of this can ever touch you if you are with Him completely, if you dwell with Him. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing thing to say to someone. What a way to lift you up if you were to read that, to say that
you may experience trials,
right?
But
the earth is cracking open, the seas are turning to blood, the fish are all dying, but you will be safe. You will be here with me, no matter what. And that's, I think, it's very uplifting to hear something like that.
The text continues, "And he who was seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' Also, he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.'" The concept of new things, John once again borrows from Isaiah 43, verse 19. The word trustworthy is pistos, which is translated faithful in other parts of Revelation, such as chapter 3, verse 14, and chapter 19, verse 11, where Jesus is called faithful and true. The text continues, "And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment.'" It is done. The word done is ginomai. At the cross, Jesus said, "It is finished." finished being the word teleo. So they are two different words.
So what's the difference?
Teleo means completion, a fulfillment, an end. Ginomai has more of a sense of to be created, to come into existence. It's more of a beginning than an end.
So why is it translated done?
It just...
it's like you could say, it is created. It
yeah.
is done.
Yeah, as in... As
it's
in,
happening.
I made it.
It's happening.
It's I made it. I did it.
It's about the new creation. So it is done is... So what it... What is done? The making all things new is done.
He just refurbished the earth for us.
What is the trajectory of the entire Hebrew history as described in the Bible? Things start out well, and then it goes horribly wrong, and the entire rest of the story is God trying to restore.
And I've been playing with that word you said.
And here he says it is restored.
Redecorated. Done.
We've been playing with that word trustworthy, faithful. So I just added on a couple more. Consistent. You know, that's kind of the opposite of what we've been saying the sea was, because the sea was chaos. So it is done. Is that the chaos has been done away with, and now we have something consistent that we can rely on.
On which to build.
Yeah.
Yes, organized.
See, on which to build our identity.
Modern, present-day Western Christians, when we hear salvation, we immediately think individual salvation.
Now,
that's not what John would have had in mind. That's not what Paul had in mind when they talked about salvation or restoration. We go to Romans chapter 18, verse 19, where it reads, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption of sons, the redemption of our bodies." So, human beings are part of creation. What Paul is saying in Romans is God's purpose through Christ is to restore and to recover all of creation, of which human beings are a part. That's why the new earth, the new heavens, the new earth is so important. It was their understanding that all of creation would be restored and returned to what the Hebrew term would be shalom, a state of peace.
You said a long time ago that if God created man with freedom, sin was not necessary, but it was inevitable.
Yeah.
Therefore, the first creation, it was inevitable that the first creation has to go through, and like we were talking about earlier this morning, the growing pains of teenage rebellion.
Exploration.
And this is the culmination of that creation. So basically, his creation isn't finished yet until we are in the fullness of him, which we can't get there without... No, I don't want to say that.
Yeah, it's... There's a difference between necessary and inevitable. But at the same time, through the inevitable, we are afforded a greater view, a more complete picture of God than if the inevitable never happened.
The inevitable, when you give people all free choice, the odds are they will not all choose.
Correct.
God. God did everything to give you total freedom to choose. But when you have total freedom to choose, the odds are that some will find a reason not to.
And some of it, and part of that may be because we don't yet have a complete picture of God. Mm-hmm. You know, we think there's something wrong with God, and so we choose some other way.
We recreate God in our own image.
We're cowardly, faithless, detestable.
The Alpha and Omega was a phrase that was found in the very first chapter of Revelation. So once again, John is bringing everything back. The beginning is the end, or the end is the beginning.
He is everything.
Yeah.
He's the creator, the redecorator, he's everything.
The image of thirsting and of living water is found in Revelation chapter 7 as well as Zechariah chapter 14. And in the Gospels, particularly in the Gospel of John. See, this is why, because there's many similarities, this is one evidence that could be used to support the premise that a single John wrote both books. It's more, yeah, doesn't prove it.
Maybe John read the other John's book.
It could be.
Yeah.
Although they were both written around the same time, so it's...
Okay.
Yeah. John chapter 4, the story of Jesus with the woman at the well. Let's go back and read that. John chapter 4.
Yeah, we never talked about that. The disciples were married, weren't they? Someone.
Peter, at least, we know was married.
There must have been Peter Jr.
So here's the section. A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the sea to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water?" And by living water, it means running fresh water. That's the literal interpretation. So that is a literal understanding that this woman would have had. The well consists of stale water.
Water that seeps in.
Yeah.
So she wouldn't have immediately thought that the water being offered was sentient.
Or metaphorically, spiritual water.
Uh-huh.
Her immediate thought was, living water was a common common phrase for a spring or a river or moving water.
So she would have been confused. He's asking me for well water when he's got fresh water already and he's offering it to me. What sense does this make?
Well, that's another thing. In our location, well water usually is purer and is clear. Maybe in that locale, maybe well water wasn't all that good. It could have been
It's an open well, for one thing. It's open, so anything can fall into it.
Yeah, well, usually a cover, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Where do you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock. Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life.
You can just see she's going, oh.
Yeah, the woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water.
Well, her first response was, this well we've got here is the best. This is the best well in town because this is Jacob's well.
We shouldn't be too hard on this woman. Because she is hearing Jesus' words and interpreting them literally.
Right.
She's already carried this heavy thing out there to get water, and now she has to fill it up and take it back.
Now, when we read it 2 millennia later, we immediately jump to the spiritual conclusion and read it in that light, and we get things all messed up. No, she was legitimately confused, but which is fine.
Yeah, when we
are. You're saying you're so great. Are you greater than Jacob? This is Jacob's well, after all.
So, I'm sure whether John, the writer of Revelation, is or is not the same as the gospel writer, doesn't matter. I'm sure the writer of Revelation had heard that story, whether it was written down by then or not. Mm-hmm. So it would seem logical that he would use the same sort of imagery and words to refer to Jesus as the source of this living water, the one who, if you drink from it, you'll never thirst. And this one of the highlights of Jesus' speaking about water is also found in the Gospel of John in chapter 7. This is during the Feast of Booths, also known as the Feast of Tabernacles.
In the fall of the year.
This feast commemorated the wanderings of Israel in the wilderness, and the people would come to Jerusalem and build booths. Literally. And people who lived in Jerusalem would build booths outside so that they could experience the tabernacle.
And these were like pole buildings with leaves and
something like that, yeah. And it is during, at the end, on the last day of the feast, this is chapter 7, verse 37 of Gospel of John, on the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. What happened on the last day was, at the temple, there was a ceremony that took place where water would be poured onto, I forget what it is, but there was a ceremony involving water.
Where the Jews
were looking forward to the promise of living water that was found in the Old Testament. And Jesus, on the very last day, gets up and says, I am that fulfillment.
It's fulfilled. He's claiming to be the fruition of the ceremony that they're doing.
And maybe it's taking the analogy too far, but I find it interesting that he did that at the Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Booths, where it was the reminder of God leading Israel, God being with Israel throughout the 40 years in the wilderness.
Well, to me it seems pretty audacious, or whatever that word is.
Oh, it was. They thought so, too. It was like, hoing!
Yeah. For 3 years, he had been doing certain things, so people knew who he was and kind of his personality, what he stood for. So if you look in the context of his personality of who they knew, that's different than just some guy standing up and saying something.
But see, there's the people that heard him. There's people who have accepted him, who are drawn to him, and there's people who have resisted him. So I think the audaciousness was to the people who had resisted him, and they're like, okay, that's over the top.
But I kind of...
Well, even so, I think a lot of people, the people who accepted him, a lot of them were accepting him as a prophet, a teacher. They weren't accepting him as the fulfillment of everything, of all of our ceremonies and everything we've done up to this time. They didn't think that he was the culmination of everything.
There's still a great deal of audacity
involved in getting up and saying something like that.
We can only imagine if somebody today had lived among us, was God, and he said, I'm God. You're just like,
and
what?
The judgment that, in the Gospel of John, it speaks a lot about judgment. That's an example of it, where God or Jesus does something that requires a decision.
In your mind.
The Gospel of John.
The Gospel of John talks about judgment.
And give me the context. I mean, you're not saying judge not that you be not judged.
No, I... Here. Chapter 5.
John 5?
Yeah, John chapter 5. So Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees and the Father is doing. For whatever this Father does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing, and greater works than these will he show him, so that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom he will. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. He does not come into judgment, but has passed from death to life. Truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming and is now here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself. And he has given him authority to execute judgment, because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. And it continues. The rest of the chapter is all about judgment and life and death.
And there are those who heard that before this episode at the temple, but the book John wasn't available yet.
Right.
Probably. Yeah. So
it's entered into that part, probably.
For the gospel writer John, judgment is something that is about a decision.
Yeah.
It's a decision that a person makes for or against Jesus' claims about himself.
Yeah, it's putting you on a crossroads.
Yeah.
Now, Jesus was famous at that.
So it's not that, Jesus has to look through all the records of a person's life and say, well, are you saved or not? But rather, it's the person saying, I want to be saved, or I reject the claims of Jesus.
I want to be yours.
Well, I'm sure that day he was in the temple, I don't care who you were, I would have a hard time. Everybody had a hard time reacting to that one.
Every person who was there could not remain neutral as to the position of Jesus and his claims.
They either
chose life by accepting Jesus' claim that he is the water of life, the living water, or they choose death by rejecting that.
And so that's why I don't understand why, like, Eastern religions can say he was a good man. Because any good man that says, I am God, I mean, they're going to, like, no, you're not. You know, I mean, how can somebody make claims and they're okay with that? They claim to be God, but you don't think they're God, they're just a good person? I mean, it's like blasphemy if you say you're God and you're not, you know.
Well, people might claim that he thought he was God. He believed he was God, but he was really out of
it. Mm.
Just a nice person.
A very good person.
The 12 disciples supposedly were in the vicinity of Jesus when he said that, and then obviously he left. What's going to, you know, they didn't leave him, they didn't abandon him, but I know in their minds they were pretty confused.
And this water is free.
That's a nice part.
This comes from Isaiah 55.
I think of bottled water.
Bottled water.
It's like tap water. Running like water.
Bottled water is like tap water, except you have to pay for it.
Yes. So this is running water that comes out of the faucet or down the hill or something.
Isaiah 55 verse 1 reads, "Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price." Yeah. "The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." Again, we've already talked about the theme of conquering that's found throughout Revelation, so we won't go into that. This heritage, what is this heritage? It's the promises that are found in verses 1 through 4. And he will be my son comes from 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 7. Second Samuel chapter 7 describes God coming to make a covenant with David. The covenant God made with David is that his throne will never cease, that he will be king over Israel, his line. And in verse 14, this is what the covenant, part of the covenant reads, "I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men, but my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you." "And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." So John in Revelation brings in this promise that was made to the Davidic line. I think it's part of the in Revelation, John pictures the saints as both priests and kings. And I think that this reference to 2 Samuel and the covenant God made with David is a reference to the king part of the image. And then the last verse that we're looking at here, "But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for the murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death." Cowardly means fearful. The non-conquerors succumb to fear. And one of the things that we've said a number of times as we've been discussing Revelation is one of the problems, the opposite of faith, is fear.
Those who don't trust.
those who don't trust. So if fear controls you, you are a coward. Now, whatever you do in response to fear is not faith. Now, if you're letting fear control your response, that's not faith. And that may be where this faithless comes in. The next word. This is apistos, or the opposite of the trustworthy or faithfulness. The opposite of what the conquerors exhibit. Finally, detestable, which means abominable or polluted. The conquerors are pictured as being dressed in robes of white. They are pure. They are undefiled. They have washed their robes. The opposite image is this detestable, this abominable, this polluted.
Well, at the beginning of the book, John was admonishing the Christians not to participate in the false worship practices. So, when he calls the people on the wrong side polluted or impure, that makes mm-hmm. sense. They've been worshiping someone under them.
And the remaining characteristics that are found in this verse 8 will be repeated again in Revelation 22, verse 15. What is important to understand is this is not a list of specific sins to be avoided, but a way of speaking about those who choose to follow the beast. Remember that throughout Revelation, it never addresses individuals, but it is addressing groups. The church as one entity and the followers of the beast as another entity.
So I can't say, well, my favorite sin is not the first one.
Correct. The books of Romans, 1 Corinthians, Galatians, 1 Peter, the Didache, the Epistle of Barnabas, etc., contain lists of virtues and vices. Non-Christian works, literature of the same period, also frequently, depending on the genre, contain lists of similar virtues and vices. So, the first thing to understand is that this is standard literary form. It's a literary form of the time to describe categories of people, not individuals. And these are given as examples. This is not supposed to be an exhaustive list or a prioritized list. Just because it appears here doesn't make it any worse than something that doesn't appear.
So this list isn't a prescription for if you do these things, you will be. But it is a way of describing the unfaithful people.
As a category.
The people, yeah. The group of people he has chosen to be against God.
It also...
That makes sense.
We can also infer from the context that because an individual may exhibit one or more of these does not mean that they are unfaithful. Because it's not talking about individuals. It's a warning against judging based upon appearances. At the same time, it doesn't mean you have permission to practice any of these things.
Judge not that you be not judged.
But he's talking about the world's systems.
Correct.
That really work. But for those people who participate in those false systems, yeah, that really do work, he's describing that false system as detestable, faithless, detestable, murderers, sexual immorality, sorcerers, idolaters. So that attribute is applicable to the world's systems that do work.
Yeah.
So if you turn it around, he's saying that systems of the world actually take advantage of people. Systems of the world actually murder people. Systems of the world are actually detestable.
Yeah, because the systems of the world, the end justifies the means. Whereas in God's system, it's the means that is more important than the ends. Because if the ends were so important, God could have destroyed all evil all at once. And
you say that very loudly. The response coming back is, oh, grow up. You know.
But we try to grow God up, and God won't.
The systems of the world work, and if you're going to succeed and have a family and make a living and do your job and excel and be somebody important, get off your high horse and just get off.
The systems of the world.
Yeah.
Find the ladder.
In the Reading Romans commentary, in regards to such lists as we have seen, it reads, "The proper way to read such lists is not to dwell so much on their individual elements as to assess their overall impact. Such lists of vices were based on the premise that wicked people tended to practice all vices, just as good people practiced all the virtues." And really, this introductory portion in verse 8, it ends with the reminder that all that is evil and oppressive will be destroyed. The systems that may work real well, but ultimately oppress. Yeah, they will destroy themselves.
So the question you have to ask yourself is, what I'm doing, is it having negative consequences on the other party? So it's not so much the focus is on me, the focus is on the other party, the effect on the other party.
Yeah. Am I using the other party? Am I trying to take advantage of them for my own good?
You're trying to stomp on them to get higher yourself or annihilate them so you can be better.
Mm-hmm. It comes back to Jesus. His life was one of living as a servant. He came to lift everyone else up, which goes completely counter to what we want.
Well, the disciples, they were right with him, and still, this is getting close to the end. And they're just like, when he kneels down to wash their feet, they're just like,
We have, because human beings have certain pictures of power. And we expect that from people in positions of power and authority. Disciples held, at that point, they probably, at least to some extent, they believed Jesus was God. I mean, how could then Jesus, being God, do something that was reserved for a slave?
And then he said, if you don't let me do this, you have no part with me. So if that fixed that, they weren't going to say, okay, well, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, it was about their pride.
Mm-hmm.
It was breaking down their assumptions about what power meant.
And they were getting lined up at that time. They were shouldered in.
The very idea that they could follow someone who presents himself as a slave was humbling to themselves as well as to him.
It was offensive to them.
Our great teacher,
it was very offensive to them.
Presenting him as a slave, what does that make us?
That's an interesting idea.
No, it's not about the washing of feet, really. it was the most degrading thing that, one of the most degrading things that Jesus could do to illustrate his point at that time.
I mentioned this once before, but I read a book, and it was about, in England, there were, I don't know what you call them, but the wealthy people that owned the land around them. Mm-hmm. And then they were responsible for all them, and then, of course, all their wealth came in. But they feel like they have a responsibility, so the peasants actually take pride in their lord's image. And if the lord didn't live up to that image, that was degrading to the peasant.
Uh-huh.
And that's a...
My lord's better than your lord.
And so the lord felt like it was his responsibility to live in that... No.
To present himself.
Yeah, and that's how it became abused.
To present. Oh. That makes sense.
So they, that...
To represent the people.
And, but that can get twisted, and that's what happened in European cultures, is those lordy people started lording it over. And we do the same thing to us. We think that a congressman is here, or a senator, or a president, or whatever. But if our president acted commonly, would that be embarrassing to us or not? Do we expect him to act and dress and... Or are we? I don't know. It's in our culture, so it's hard to differentiate.
So
that.
Maybe the feudal system started more as one person being the protector and representative of the rest of the people, rather than being like the owner and dictator of the people. That makes sense.
Is it good or bad?
Well,
it can be either way.
The thing is about
a benevolent dictatorship.
An analogy of a president being
a beautiful thing.
The analogy of a president being higher is actually skewed from what their original ideology was. The original ideology was to form a nation, hopefully, in the idea that the servitude of the government was like what Christ was trying to represent. It was, you know, we have destroyed over the years what we were trying to represent as a servant for the people, to serve each other, and because of our own disbelief in that ideology, we have created those people to be more than they are, and they have created themselves to do so also.
Yeah, it goes both ways.
So it really isn't Jesus' fault for portraying himself as a servant to us. It's our fault for not accepting him as a servant of us.
Yeah.
For not being able to, and Mark's been trying to explain this for like three verses now, that the offense of the people not to take Christ for who he is when he stands upon an altar and says, "I'm God," is all our own and not his. It's nothing that Jesus has ever done to make us embarrassed of him. It's our own embarrassment of ourselves to being worthy or not worthy that has changed his image of us.
Sing on. Our next special will be Wes.
So that brings us to the end of the introduction to John's Fourth in the Spirit experience.
Mm-hmm.
So this commentary reads, "Yet even though a magnificent vision is about to follow, John has already oriented the reader as to how to understand the vision. It is the fulfillment of a host of Old Testament passages about God dwelling personally and intimately with his people."
Somebody's trying to get over.
This is, okay, folks, this is what's coming, and here's how to understand it.
Yeah. again, strictly from a from a pure knowledge perspective, it's not necessary because it's all been presented before. But it's the emotional catharsis of a very exciting, tension-filled drama. You know, the audience wants to see a happy ending. The audience wants to see the saints rewarded.
The good guy wins.
Yeah.
The good guy has already won.
Yeah, the good guy has already won, but...
The audience wants to see the good guy rewarded.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's all up to God's interpretation of how he rewards.
This is a stupid. But obviously, there's other dramas written in that era that we have or don't have. And so, as you read those other dramas, we better understand the culture in which this drama was written. And that's probably something that's been relatively more recently becoming more and more available.
The understanding of
the
context.